Good afternoon, everybody. So, my name is Mark Parker. I'll be your moderator for this group session. So we have three education talks this afternoon, and I've been told that we want to stay on track and on time. So I will be trying to start us very close to on time and be physically yanking them off stage if necessary. No, I won't do that. Our first speaker today is Joel Light, and he's going to talk to us about students' views, or their worldviews, and how that affects their thoughts on
anthropogenic
climate change. So we'll have about a 20-minute talk, and then time for questions at the end. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Joel.
Like Mark said, my name is Joel Light. I'm from the University of Northwestern St. Paul. It's a small little Christian school in St. Paul. I've been there about 10 years. I teach. My background's in environmental education and environmental science, and been teaching there for 10 years, but I kind of did things backwards, and so I just recently, last year, finished my PhD, because I kind of like that when you're teaching on the university level. So this is actually my dissertation research that I'll be sharing today. So thinking about, you know, as I was thinking about research, I was thinking about, in my context, teaching evangelicals, teaching environmental topics, climate change has always been a difficult one to teach. And so as I was looking through the literature, it comes up that evangelicals are largely resistant to the acceptance of anthropogenic climate change. You know, we saw that today with Catherine Hale's talk. And, there's not a lot of knowledge out there of why specifically that is. And, you know, there's thoughts on why it is, but not specifically. And so knowing why they might be resistant would help then in designing curriculum and instruction specifically to address some of those things. And when we look at the evangelical culture, the group, especially in the United States, we see that they are very influential. Make up 30% of the population, but they have great political power, they have social capital, and so really to do any kind of movement for climate change policy in the United States, we got to get the evangelicals on board. And so this led me to this kind of primary research question of it: in what ways does an evangelical college student's worldview, specifically the religious, environmental, economic, political, and epistemological areas of belief, relate to his or her anthropogenic climate change literacy, that is, his or her knowledge, belief, and acceptance of anthropogenic climate change? So as you can see from the length of this question, this is a qualitative study. And you can see that, you know, you got to be really specific as your dissertation, right? So you have to have a lot of words to be specific. So hopefully you followed what I was saying there. And so, part of why I chose college students is because, I have a captive audience being a professor at a school, a Christian school, where they are identified as evangelicals. But also because that's the time where worldview solidification and exploration is happening. So their worldview is a little more malleable at that time. And so it gives us a good opportunity to kind of see what could happen. And so based on the literature, I kind of came up with a conceptual framework of three propositions. So the first one is that evangelical students' worldviews are made up of areas of belief. And when you look at the research on knowledge and belief, they're very much intertwined. They have to be consistent with one another, and so and belief becomes pretty important, and so often knowledge is used to kind of solidify belief, and so when contradictory knowledge comes into play, that can cause a crisis of belief in a student, and especially if those beliefs are affective type beliefs, then they tend to hang on to those beliefs very strongly. And so then there's also a range of knowledge, belief, and acceptance of anthropogenic climate change among evangelical college students. So when we look at the evangelical population, not everybody is the same. And so some people there's actually kind of a continuum then of acceptance and knowledge and belief on climate change. There's some that are pretty staunch deniers, and there's some that are you know, leading the charge of action. And so we wanted to, you know, get a good cross-section of why is there a difference? They're from the same tribe. Why do they have such differing beliefs and acceptance? And then the third one is the evangelical college student's worldview relates to his or her knowledge, belief, and acceptance of anthropogenic climate change. That, you know, how we view things, the beliefs that we have, the knowledge that we have, really connects with the things that we then process and interact with. And so it needs to be included in the discussion. So we have to analyze and understand a person's worldview, where they're coming from, how they're, you know, what the filter is that they're bringing this information in order to understand how to teach them. And so again, based on the literature, there's this continuum of acceptance of anthropogenic climate change in this group. And so in the review of literature, I kind of came up with kind of three major categories. Now, they're not hard, fast groups, but they were helpful in characterizing, making sure that in my research I had kind of a wide range of individuals. And so we have the dismissive, doubtful group, the skeptical, cautious group, and the concerned, active group. And there can be kind of overlap between these two, and there can be kind of people in the middle of these three groups. But they were helpful in kind of helping me to know, okay, I have, you know, people along this spectrum. When we're thinking about the dismissive, doubtful group, this would be the group that, you know, really doesn't believe in anthropogenic climate change, doesn't accept it, I guess is a better way to say that. You know, they would be folks that might admit that climate change is happening, but that it's a part of God's plan, that God's in control, that God wouldn't do anything in the environment to affect humankind, and that they're very wary of scientific evidence, they're very wary of any kind of political or governmental kind of action. The skeptical, cautious group, they might be a little bit more environmental in their ideas on stewardship. They might be more a little more green than the dismissive, doubtful group. They might concede a little bit that humans have an effect, but they're a little hesitant to do big-scale changes in policy and in action. They would say that the economy, that humankind is the most important, and so we don't want to do anything that would affect that. And then the concerned active people are kind of right in line with kind of the other environmental people out there that they accept anthropogenic climate change, they accept that we need to do something about it, they accept the science. The skeptical, cautious people are still a little bit wary of science, particular science, but the concerned active people, you know, they're kind of on board, they're ready to go. So what I did in the research was I used a case study approach, is that when we're working with very specific contexts, case studies are the best way to go. And it, based on the question, the qualitative research paradigm just made sense. And so I was able to get representatives from each of those groups of those individual college students. And I used 8 instruments of data collection. So it was a fairly sophisticated study, a lot of data coming from this group, using prompts and things to get responses then that I could code. So then you go through a process. If you're not familiar with qualitative data, you have all this text, and so then you read through the text and you let the text kind of speak to you. It's kind of like what we do with the Bible, only in this research I don't necessarily have the Holy Spirit to help me out, well, maybe I do. I kind of feel like I did, but you allow the themes to emerge. Okay, so what are the commonalities? What are the things you're seeing as you're reading through the narratives that you're constructing? So I'm taking this text and constructing this narrative of each of these people, and then I'm taking those narratives and I'm comparing them across one another. So I'm looking at the dismissive people, I'm looking at the concerned people, and I'm kind of saying, what is the commonalities among this group? What is the differences in those kinds of things? To kind of help understand why these differences exist. So in looking at the cross-case analysis, there's some pretty clear differences between those who accept and those who don't. And some of these you might have been like, well, yeah, I could have said that too. But, you know, it's always good to have data to support that. So when we look at evangelicals that accept, they have a more positive view towards science. They're a little more hands-on with science. They're going to read the things that are out there. They tended to have a more integrated understanding of climate change, so they kind of understood, at least on a basic sense, how climate change works and why it works the way it does. They had an acceptance that humans could, in fact, affect planetary systems. That was a real important thing. That can we, piddly little humans, affect these big systems? And would God allow that to happen? They had more of a harmonious view of the relationship between God's humans and the environment. So thinking that each of those groups have their roles to play and that there's this kind of give and take among those groups. They saw climate change as a threat to two really key religious values that they held very strongly, creation care and social justice. And so in that, there was a lot of empathy that came out in their responses about suffering of people. And so they had more of a global perspective on what was going on. And this was a really important thing that came out, is that they had key people from their culture that influenced their views. So, you know, this professor, this person, this mentor influenced that. The ones that resisted had more of a skeptical view towards science, more of a segmented knowledge. They kind of had some misconceptions. They didn't quite understand how it worked. They had a little bit harder time accepting that humans could affect planetary systems. So they would deny that humans affect the environment or that there's environmental problems, but that they're localized. You know, things like, well, we should recycle, we should pick up trash, things like that. They had a more hierarchical view of the relationship between God, humans, and the environment. So God is more hands-off with the environment. We are kind of in control of the environment. We get to kind of do what we want. And they saw climate change as unimportant because they had two religious views that were really a lot more important than these others over here. Evangelism, that was really the most important thing, and that God's sovereignty that's not our place, that we're not really supposed to be involved in worrying about that. So they tended that the empathy was lower. They had a more self-focused perspective, and they were missing those positive voices. And they didn't have those people influencing them. So when I think about the answer to this question, what's the short answer to this question? Well, worldview matters. We can't ignore that. And we can't ignore religious belief and things like that when we're talking about science. And largely we do that oftentimes. And that this doesn't work. And so religious beliefs really are at the core, specifically for evangelicals, they're really at the core, and a lot of other things get filtered through those religious beliefs. And so it's really important then that if we want to anchor something in a person's worldview, we have to connect it to that core. Okay, so we have to find inroads in to connect it into these deep things. And if it is inconsistent with that core, that can cause problems. And so values have to come into play, and values become almost more important than the scientific data. Not that the scientific data isn't important, but we start the conversation in a different place than we think we would. And so that was kind of surprising to me, why don't we just give them the numbers, right? We kind of heard that this morning with Catherine Hayhoe, too. It's like, well, in fact, I had a conversation with her. She switched from climate science to political science because she's like, well, I've collected all the data. I got to figure out how else to get these people, okay, because I have all the data that's not working. And so it's coming up in other places. So when we think about, then, what does this mean for curriculum and instruction, we come up with some of the things that we see in the curriculum is that a lot of students had a lot of issues with trying to figure out this difference between regional change and global change. You know, what does it mean to you know, it doesn't feel different in Minnesota. I teach in Minnesota. It's like, we had a cold winter, right? So what about that? And so understanding this like global scale of change and regional scale of change and what the differences are, and also the time scales and rates of change, you know, that it's not so much that the climate doesn't change, it's that it's changing fast, and the magnitude is quite large. And so looking at patterns, not understanding that, not really understanding what data and evidence is, like how do we collect science, how do we collect climate data, and why do we feel confident about that? And a really big thing that comes into the curriculum is the impacts of change. Why do we care? You know, so what? You know, and so specific and current examples. So one thing I've done in my teaching, I've switched completely to a more case study approach to teaching. So here's this case, this is the story, this is what's happening. And then we go back in and we talk about the science of why that's happening. Why is Tuvalu disappearing as an island nation? Well, sea level rise, right? So then we go back in, so we show them Tuvalu, we tell them the story, we tell them what's happening culturally there, and then we go back in. And so looking at how is human influence come into play. So then when we look at instruction, like as far as how to teach, again, we're looking at real world examples. This is like what is happening. Okay? And even local examples is helpful too. So I go through 23 ways that Minnesota is changing. Right? And they've observed some of those. These two get a little trickier if you're in a secular situation, because religious principles and language matters. So how we talk to people matters. And so, you know, if I use the word stewardship, that conveys better than environmentalism, you know, environmental protection and conservation. And so, you know, using the biblical principles as the way of teaching is helpful. So I'm connecting it back to those core values. If I can show people that this is consistent with their core values, they're more likely to kind of shift their thinking. And this one was really interesting, that it really matters who's doing the talking. And so I actually use Catherine Hale a lot in my class, because I can show these other evangelicals that she loves Jesus, right? That she's, you know, when you're married to a pastor, that helps. In my culture, that's like next to being, you know, divine. It's like you're married to a pastor. You know, so that's cool. So, I tend to not tell them that my mom used to be a pastor, because that gets a little bit tricky in certain settings. You know, I keep that one quiet. But, you know, it matters. So even myself, I spend a lot of time kind of establishing that I'm a part of the tribe. So I spend several weeks establishing I'm part of the tribe. A lot of my students aren't students that I've had before. They're non-majors. They're scared to take a science class, you know. And so it's this idea of these, what I call climate prophets, you know, of, you know, how do we get these people that are from the culture that can talk the language and who have, you know, it's not that they really should have more validity than this other person over here, but it matters that they're part of the group. And so, you know, when I think about this, you know, teaching environmental type things in a Christian school, a very conservative Christian school, can be, you know, tough. I went to the serotonin talk today, and I was like, oh, this is why I'm so depressed, right? So I'm going to, you know, I was just going to up my serotonin levels. So I'm trying to, you know, I try to be positive. My wife tries to tell me to be positive. So my final summary is I'm landing on hope, because what I noticed in the research is that most of the students could at least say that the climate is changing. You know, there's people that don't even think it's changing. Right? But among these students, at least this generation seems to be okay. They've kind of grown up with this, and so they're more like, okay, it is, I'll concede it's changing. So that was positive. The other positive is that most of them say, well, we should probably take care of the environment. Okay? And so
some way, shape, or form. Maybe they didn't want to go too extreme with that, but they thought the government should do some things about the environment. And so that was encouraging. And the other thing that it was encouraging was that, you know, some students started to shift just from the prompts that they were beginning, you know, in the thought process of critically thinking about these things that they were reading and watching, that I already started to see some shifting. That wasn't even the purpose of the study, but I saw that shift. And so it seems to me that it's possible that this can be done. That maybe not so much for the really, really dismissive people, but for especially that group in the middle, we might be able to, given the right kind of avenue of going after it, we might be able to get them to kind of shift their thinking. And I really, again, I feel like that has to happen if we're really going to do anything in the United States on climate change. And so I got to do this last semester. I changed my class based on this research. I haven't had time to analyze the data, but hopefully I'll see this consistency of this shift. So, anecdotally, I witnessed it, but got data. So hopefully in the future you'll hear from me that I have the data for that. So we have a little bit of time for questions, I think. And got some sources here too. So it's good. You want those big look to see? I'm smart.
How big was your sample size?
So case studies are very small because of the amount of data. So I only had 8 individuals. Okay, so that's a very small sample size. So I definitely need working on getting more. Yeah, so that's part of this class, doing this next step.
I meant how many, when you came up with your initial, when you worked with students, like how many students did you have?
So I started, so basically, when I first solicited responses, I had over 100. Mm-hmm. And then I pared them down based on interest and then based on things. So at the end, I had 8 individuals that were the cases.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So 8 individuals over the cases with 8 data points, basically. So when you figure, so they each read 8 prompts, at which, and they had several pages for each prompt that they wrote about for that. So a lot of the data and qualitative is coming from the amount of text that you're working with. Yeah.
At the beginning, you identified several, the worldview of these students. Try to correlate those aspects of their incoming worldview with their incoming view of climate change?
So, so again, the purpose wasn't the change. In this case, wasn't the change.
Oh, okay.
So, what I was mostly doing in this study was to say, why are they different? So, but the interesting thing is that some did change. So some, there was a couple cases where they started at more in that dismissive place, and then I had to recategorize them because as they learned and wrestled with it, they actually were more in this way. And again, that wasn't the purpose. This next study, that's the purpose. Hopefully I'll see that. But basically this was just to categorize them and then say, why are they different? And so, a lot of the prompts were about categorizing. Yeah.
I've read several studies where people have done multivariate analysis based on surveys and find that the best predictor of positions on climate change are political parties.
Yeah. As right.
As anything else.
But we're talking, but I wonder if that's, I don't know the studies, but some of the new studies coming up is that young evangelicals, that's not the case. That politics aren't the case. And now that could be that becomes the case as they age. I didn't get involved in politics until, when I was 18, 22, I didn't get involved in politics. I know a few students of mine that are. But that didn't come out in this study. It wasn't
politics. It seems to be the information. not so much that you choose the party because of climate change, but because the information that flow, that the ecosystem that you live in.
Right, so I would argue that's not necessarily based on political values, because the political values weren't what were coming up, but it was more of the voices that were coming in. And so it really matters the voice that they're getting. And so so in my class, I find conservative voices who are Republican talk about climate change. So a good local example of one, and actually his book is up in the bookstore. Thank you. Is Paul Douglas. Yeah, Paul Douglas. He completely changed his views on climate change. He's a meteorologist too, but completely changed views. Yeah, just total Republican, conservative. And so I try to find those, you know, they're rare, but I try to find those views. But I would say it didn't seem, from the data didn't indicate that it was because of political values, but because of religious values and the charter.
Some of my conservative friends seem to think that if there is a problem, government is not necessarily the best way to handle it. And probably a smaller group would say, if the information is coming from the government, it may be a suspect too.
Right.
But as far as, are there other ways for those who like government solutions?
Right.
To provide solutions?
So that's where, you know, I think the social justice piece comes into play. So there's a lot of organizations that are working in climate change that aren't necessarily, and maybe they're doing some lobbying, maybe they're doing some work with the government, but they're doing more localized solutions. So it seems that students really valued when there was direct solutions, not just kind of big solutions, where they feel like they were, where they had organizations that were actually on the ground with the suffering people. So it seems like the suffering, kind of the social justice issues, tends to be kind of one of the main pathways for conveying that knowledge. And that doesn't really come from governmental sources. You know, it tends to come more from the people that are out there interacting with the people. That helps, yeah.
I'm kind of curious, when you hear about climate change, usually the first thing you think about is those graphical views, like almost like the end of the world type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like those are prevailing over as far as what people hear about climate change and global warming.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you find, like, counteracting those stereotypes, I guess?
Right. Well, and I think that's, you know, when we're talking about crowd sovereignty and those kind of arguments that got with them a lot, you know, you got in that group, you would see, you tend to see either this is part of the end times, like this is God bringing the end times. So there was a little bit of that that came up. Or that was the resistance, is, well, God's not going to let us. And so those messages don't tend to work with that particular audience. Because it's like, well, God's not going to do that. God's, you know, he said he wouldn't destroy the earth again. Right? And that's not necessarily true either. But
I think we have time for maybe one more.
Yeah, so you said you work at a conservative institution. How does your institution feel about you teaching climate change?
Well, you know, that's a good question. So far, so far it hasn't been a problem. You know, I always get a little nervous, but you know, some of the key administrators that I'm working with are okay with it and welcome it. I think that if the greater community knew, you know, some of my other colleagues in other departments or outside of Northwestern knew that I was teaching, I'm teaching very small class sizes, so the secret isn't out yet, I guess. So far my job's been okay. So
you two should talk.
You have some shares of that commiseration.
Robin, did you have a quick one?
I was just going to comment that when I looked at your list of how to set your curriculum to make it work,
yeah,
it seems to me that the first four were just basic scientific literacy.
Right.
Reach over level change.
what specifically happens if you think that, you know, those that are in the public school would be, but, you know, it didn't seem like it was a, that influence, that previous knowledge, scientific knowledge coming in, as far as if you accept or not. You know, so that public school students were like, no, and I had homeschool students that were like, yes. But I, those were the misconceptions for sure. That was the missing information that maybe leads to some of this resistance, at least on the scientific piece. And then if you put in the values piece, then hopefully, you know, tying those together, then we can shift. So, thank you very much, Phil.